Morning, girls.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. Viet Dinh and Perry Barber for Appellant M2Z Networks. I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honor, this case concerns spectrum that's laid fallow since 1992 when the FCC first designated it for new services and technology. Over the next decade, nothing happened. No assignment rules, no service rules. And so M2Z took the initiative and filed an application to prompt action in the spectrum to meet the FCC and Congress's purported purpose for the spectrum. The application under Section 309, the General Licensing Authority, was accepted in January of 2007. And when it was accepted, there follow on a number of tag-along petitions seeking to deny the application and the petition for forbearance of M2Z. Now, importantly, the proposal of M2Z proposed a new service and using new technology. It proposes a free nationwide universal broadband access that has a voluntary family-friendly tier filter, so there would not be a state action problem with respect to such filters. And it proposed an innovative spectrum license fee, 5% of the revenue coming from the premium service of M2Z's the application.
Is that what was new about it, was that it was nationwide and had these family-friendly features and give back to the Treasury Department? Is that what's new about this?
Yes, Your Honor. It is nationwide, mm-hmm. It is free, and it has a family-friendly filter. And also it uses new technology in a different combination. And so both a new service and new technology.
It's the position of the FCC that it doesn't involve new technology. That in fact, and I don't know the acronyms, but that those are actually existing technologies that are offered. Are they wrong on that?
I have discovered the acronyms. It's orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, which is the traditional technology. What we propose to use is orthogonal frequency division multiple access. The difference between the two, according to the WiMAX industry standard, is that you can divide a signal into different channels. What multiple access allows to do is multiple channels to be used at the same time, therefore making more efficient use of the spectrum. And more importantly, M2Z proposes to combine different technology in an innovative way. Much like a fax machine, prior to the fax machine, there was a telephone line and there were printers. Until you combine those two into a new use and a new technology, there were no fax machine. Similar here, we combine TTD, AAS, and OFDMA in order to provide more efficient spectrum use.
The FCC claims that this is actually slower than some of the other proposals out there.
It is clear that our proposed speed met the definition of broadband in existence at the time. Mm-hmm. It was not as fast as the commercially available services, obviously, because they charge for those services. Our premium tier had higher speeds, but more importantly, Section 7 requires the agency to shift the burden when there is new technology or service. It doesn't necessarily say that it has to be better, faster build-out kind of technology. I think Section 7 clearly evinces congressional intent to put new technology out into the diversity of the marketplace for it to be.
You're not wanting in the marketplace. You're wanting to close the marketplace. And frankly, this is about the most breathtaking breadth of a forbearance petition I've seen. I've only been here a little over 21 years, but I've never seen one before that was that broad. Are you familiar with any place where we've said the FCC erred for not granting a forbearance petition that says we're going to forbear from following any law that gets in the way of them having exclusive use here?
It was broad, Your Honor, but only because of necessity, because there were no assignment of service rules in place, and despite the 14 year of the spectrum being fallow, and so we can't shoot at a moving target.
What they're wanting to do is put rules in place, right?
Well, they are trying
FCC
to put.
FCC is wanting to have a rulemaking as to how this is to be competitively allocated in the marketplace, right?
No question about that, and that NPRM has closed. However, Your Honor, this court's decision in AT&T forecloses that course of action for the FCC. The court made clear in the AT&T that the FCC cannot deny a petition for forbearance simply in preference of more process. At least in that case, there was an ongoing NPRM. In this case, the NPRM was only promised and only subsequently promulgated and concluded. I think AT&T squarely forecloses the decision not to decide in favor of more process.
What's your burden before the FCC in obtaining the forbearance?
I think the burden before the FCC is that we have to show that it is within the public interest. And in so showing, the FCC has to consider Section 10B requires the FCC that it shall consider competitive market conditions. Here, the only place the FCC tried to do so is in footnote 34, and we submitted that is inadequate.
Does the statute say they can't consider it in a footnote?
No, Your Honor, but this court's decisions in Getty, the Supreme Court's decision in State Farm make clear that where a statute requires consideration, that it cannot be conclusory, it cannot be in passing, it cannot be a drive-by type of observation as we've seen here. It's merely conditional.
We would be reverting to Boston Television question of whether Boston Community, whatever that case is, question between whether this is tolerably terse or intolerably silent.
Not only that, Your Honor, but this goes back to your earlier question regarding the competitive markets. Mm-hmm. Footnote 34 talks about the market for licenses. Mm-hmm. I think if you read Section 10A clearly, it looks to the consumer market, the competitive market condition for underlying consumers.
If you give an exclusive license, there is no consumer market at that point. You foreclosed it.
Oh, there is a consumer market for broadband service, and we would be putting more consumers at the use of broadband because we would be providing universal free access.
Somebody will be putting more consumers at use. Somebody will have this bad.
But not necessarily according to the terms that we propose.
And
our proposal, of course, our proposal, the public interest behind our proposal is that it would be free, it would be nationwide, and thereby bridging the digital divide that Congress and FCC have said that a significant problem within our country. I think that adding this service, adding new user to the broadband marketplace is a pro-competitive condition. What the FCC did in footnote 34, even you think that it is adequate, is simply looking at the wrong market. It simply says, well, we can't grant this petition because we don't want to foreclose the competitive bidding on the license. If that's the case,
doesn't 10B require that they look at and will enhance competition among providers of telecommunication services? It's not just the consumers, it's the providers, and that's precisely what they looked at.
No, I think Your Honor, I agree, it's providers, provision of the telecommunication services, but you can't simply look at the competition in the spectrum allocation. If that's the case, then 309J, the auctioning process, mm-hmm. would completely trump the Section 10B and Section 10A. I think it is clear that you have to look at the Section 10 the requirements as the consumer market, not simply the market for bidding of licenses. Sure, it is about providers, that there would be more providers in the marketplace so that there would be more vibrant competition in the underlying market for telecommunication services. It is not the market for the spectrum itself, because otherwise 309J would always trump Section 10B, and in such an event, the court has made clear both in AT&T that Section 10B cannot be so trumped. That's the gravamen of our problem here, is that the commission decided not to decide, in contrary to the court's teachings in AT&T, and even when it tried to decide in footnote 34, it looked at the wrong market, and it did so only in passing. And so that's why there is clear legal error here, both under AT&T, because it would create a bypass to Section 10B, and also a simple failure to adhere to the statutory text that it shall consider the market, the competitive marketplace of the provision for services. Section 7 comes into play, obviously.
Mr. Din, you'll acknowledge that you have some waiver problems here, don't you? I mean, our case law is pretty clear that under 405, we construe 405 strictly, so that if there's an argument that somehow the FCC made an inadequate explanation or didn't look at the record evidence in sufficient fashion, that those sorts of arguments are supposed to be brought in reconsideration. And a number of your arguments seem to me to to fall within that category, that they're somehow inadequate explanations by the FCC, or somehow the FCC didn't look sufficiently at record evidence?
It depends on what you mean by the question of law under Section 405. I would not concede that we have 405 problems, because Section 405 clearly says that a petition for reconsideration may be filed, not that it must be filed in every single case. If the FCC position is taken at its face and require a petition for reconsideration every single juncture and every jot and tittle.
The case law does require that the FCC be given a fair opportunity to pass on the questions before they come to the court.
Yes, Your Honor, it does.
Is that, and that's our waiver cases, have you failed to give them that full opportunity?
No, we have not, Your Honor, because we have presented the questions of law to the FCC, both in our application and our petition for reconsideration and in our numerous filings. The question then becomes how specific you define the question presented to the FCC and therefore to this court. The question presented here is whether the agency had failed to adhere to Section 10, Section 7, and adequately follow procedure under Section 309A. We don't have to, under this court's teaching, most significantly in the Time Warner case, as well as NABB, spell out every single jot and tittle and write a roadmap as to
spell
how.
Out the, you have to spell out the same thing to the FCC you spell out to us, though, don't you?
That's exactly right, and we do spell these things out. What we spell out is that
not
there are
every jot and tittle, but the same jots and tittles that you bring to us here.
I think the question is a question of characterization as to the question presented. We properly presented the questions of public interest under Section 309 as well as Section 10.2. To the agency, is there an obligation that we say, well, you probably should not have made footnote 34 in an observation that in a subjunctive mood? I think that's really going to the sub arguments rather than the question presented. Section 3405 requires that questions of law and fact be presented to the commission, and the commission be afforded an opportunity to pass upon it. It does not require specific sub arguments to be presented.
Judge Griffith made reference to the inadequacy of explanation being something that we have generally expected petitioners to bring to the attention of the agency, and that sounds like what you're saying about footnote 34. The thing you're saying is wrong with 34 is it's an inadequate explanation. Is that not correct?
No, not necessarily, Your Honor, because it is a substantive failure to consider. It is not simply an inadequate.
Obviously, they did consider. They wrote the footnote.
No, they said we would observe and did not look at the underlying market.
We should allow a petition because of the difference between observing and considering.
Not only that, Your Honor, but certainly Getty and State Farm itself said that that is sufficient under the APA in order to reverse. But more importantly, as our conversation earlier noted, there is a substantive problem with the definition of the relevant market, also the market for spectrum versus the competitive market. But more significantly, the court's most recent teaching on this subject in Time Warner says very clearly and logically that Section 405 prevents petitioners from playing a game of gotcha with the commission. Nobody's playing gotcha with anybody. Everybody presented all the questions to the commission. Were the rule contrary-wise, we would have to bring a petition for reconsideration for every single time that we identify a mistake in an order. And then if we don't get relief, we have to do a consideration of the consideration. And nowhere does 405 or this court's exhaustion doctrine requires that kind of endless loop. I think it is sufficient that a reasonable commission construed that the question is necessarily implicated in our questions presented. We don't have to present the same arguments and the sub-arguments. And I think NABB is exactly on the same vein. There, the commission was not afforded an opportunity to pass on the validity of the underlying order that was at issue. It was conceded. It was not presented at all. And yet the court says that is necessarily implicated in the question presented both to the FCC and to this court. So the question is not whether or not we have said the exact same thing and filed the exact same brief, but whether our arguments necessarily implicates the arguments that are presented here. And I would submit that any other definition of the question presented would make 405 into a mandatory reconsideration statute, which this court has never held. The question with respect to Section 309J, the auction process, I would concede that this case would be entirely different had there been assignment and service rules in place under Section 309J. in such a situation, then indeed for us to come in here and ask the court to forego that process and give us forbearance would be a strong request indeed. But here what we have is Spectrum that's laid fallow, and the FCC has done nothing to allocate it. And what we have done is taken advantage of the congressional prompting under Section 7 to propose a new service and a new technology, and under general authority under Section 309A to allocate this spectrum. The FCC, in accepting the application for filing, recognizes that Section 309A controls, that is general licensing authority. Under that authority, the FCC is required, shall consider the public interest, convenience, and necessity of the application itself, and if it so deems, then it shall grant the grant the application. What the FCC tries to do here is to interject a prospective probable NPRM for the auction under 309J as a way for it not to decide the petition for forbearance under Section 10, not to decide the application under Section 309A, both of which affirmatively requires the FCC to take on and consider the public interest of our application. Now, the FCC did, in footnote 36, cite a number of cases in which the FCC has says that our preferred method is to auction. That is our public interest in allocating the spectrum. That is all fine and good. We do not challenge any of those cases cited or the purported public interest in allocating spectrum.
I want to make sure you don't run out of time before you speak to 157A, which you cite with reference to the burden shifting.
Yes, sir.
Now, as I read your brief, you're saying that the phrase other than the commission in that statute does not mean other than the commission.
Your Honor, it does.
Explain to me why the phrase other than the commission does not mean other than the commission.
For one thing, the phrase is in parenthetical, and so
right. The phrase in the parenthetical, other than the commission. Right. Why does that not within the parenthetical mean other than the commission?
I will admit to you, and as I think the co-counsel will also admit to you, that 157 is not an expertly drafted statute. What you have here is two choices.
We rarely have a case over here where either party claims the statute is expertly drafted.
What you have in that second sentence is you have one of two choices. You can read it as the commission reads it, which basically reads the burden shift out of the statute completely. Or you can read the way we read it, which gives flower to that parenthetical as the decision maker. The FCC has to have the parenthetical clarifies that the FCC as the decision maker is not in a position to oppose, and so as the decision maker is not obligated to follow the burden shifting. That makes perfect sense. Any burden shifting statute here, you as the decision maker would not be bound by it, and that parenthetical makes clear that is the case. Because I guess in some circumstances the commission can propose new service and technology, it has never done so, there may be a situation whereby the commission may be in a position of opposition.
Is often opposed particular technologies or particular applications, though, right?
Yes, Your Honor, but not in particular, not under 157 specifically. And so here it preserves the province of the FCC as a decision maker.
We should not only hold that they're wrong, but they're totally unreasonable by their interpretation of this statute. You are under Chevron here, aren't you?
I think their reading out the entire burden shift is contrary to 1 of Chevron.
Reading out the entire burden shift, they would still say that before the commission, the statute can be effective to shift the burden,
but only in a situation, it seems to me, where the 157C comes into play.
Otherwise, in equipoise or undecided, and there are multiple parties, then the burden could still be shifted by the statute.
Well, but it would be shifted. First of all, there are not multiple parties here because ours is the only application that is accepted for filing.
So I know, but you're telling me they've completely read the statute out of existence by their reading.
But it does read the burden shift completely out of existence, Your Honor, because if that's the case, there is no reason for the FCC ever to grant any burden shifting because the FCC is not obligated by it. I think the decision maker is not obligated. That's true as far as it goes. But the parties competing parties have the obligation to disprove that it is inconsistent in the public interest. And I'll reserve the remaining of my time for my rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. Question here on your AT&T argument. As you point out, this case would be entirely different if there had been spectrum rules in place. Why is that not a principal basis for distinguishing the AT&T?
Because there are no spectrum rules in place right now, and AT&T itself did not have the spectrum rules in place, and AT&T said that you cannot pretermit our rights under forbearance in favor of further process, that Section 10 obligates the FCC to address the public interest of our application itself.
So you view it as directly on point.
Is absolutely directly on point. If anything, is our fortiori, because our case, in our case, there is not even a pending NPRM. There was only a promise of a future NPRM.
Thank you,
Your Honor. I reserve the remaining of my time.
Thank you, Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Joel Marcus for the FCC in the United States. Chief Judge Santel, I could not agree with you more that M2Z's position here is breathtaking, and not just because of the scope of their forbearance request, but because of the fundamental nature of what they're after here. They came to the Commission and said, in effect, our proposal is so good that you don't need to even hear what anyone else might do with this spectrum. Forbear from all of your usual processing rules, the rules that ensure fairness to other parties, the rules that ensure that applicants are financially and technically qualified, and ignore the six other applications that have been submitted for this very spectrum.
Why can't you look at it slightly differently and say the spectrum's been fallow, the Commission hasn't done anything with it, now we have an idea, we think it's terrific.
I think that
Congress has enacted legislation that anticipates that precisely this type of thing might happen.
I think it would be a gross mischaracterization to describe this spectrum as fallow. For one thing, there are 18...
To describe it as what?
To describe it fallow? As fallow, Judge Rogers. Right. For one thing, there are 1,800 active licensees on this spectrum. And for another thing, the Commission has been actively managing this block of spectrum for about 10 years. This spectrum was not fully allocated to the AWS-3 allocation until 2005. And so it's in use right now. It may not be in the best possible use right now, but that is exactly what the Commission has been trying to do over the course of many rulemakings. These matters are highly technically complex, Judge Rogers. There are interference concerns. There are technical matters having to do with paired and unpaired spectrum and things
that... Just that I'm not understanding the use of the word fallow, then?
Well, I think that... It's not that you are not understanding the use of the word fallow, but that M2Z has described a situation that's not in fact true. I mean, I don't call spectrum that has 1,800 licenses on it fallow, and I don't consider a matter that has been the subject of active Commission management, including most recently in 2005, before this spectrum block was fully assembled, to be sitting around doing nothing.
You don't dispute in your brief the characterization as fallow, do you? Apparently Judge Rogers doesn't think you did, and I don't remember you doing so either.
Okay, well,
if you did so, at least two of us may have missed that.
It does have the Commission NPRM that it issued here, and in paragraph 9 of the supplemental appendix, this is at page 8 of that supplemental appendix, you can see that the first sentence in paragraph 9 says, there are numerous incumbents in the band, which contains over 1,800 active licenses. And so if there was
perhaps should have stressed that in your brief.
I do apologize for having overlooked that matter. Perhaps we didn't think of it as important a point as the court did, but the Commission has stressed in the place that I've just pointed out to you, as well as others, that this is not fallow spectrum. Now, again, to be fair, the Commission has decided that the uses that are on this spectrum are not necessarily the best uses for this spectrum, but it's important to stress here that the Commission has been actively managing this spectrum, and it was not finalized for the AWS-3 block until 2005. And in the meantime, the Commission has been dealing with service rules and licensing rules for the AWS 1 block and the AWS 2 block. So in other words, this is the third block of this big chunk of spectrum, and the commission has been actively working on this, but it takes some time to do this. These are very complicated matters. And in fact, one thing that makes very clear why it's so important to proceed in a well-considered manner rather than in the kind of rash manner that M2Z would have us proceed in is that in the course of the ongoing rulemaking, it has turned out that there are significant interference concerns between this AWS 3 spectrum and the immediately adjacent AWS 1 and 2 spectrum.
So let me just be clear. There are 1,800 licensees on this spectrum that's at issue.
That's correct.
But there are no service rules out there?
Well, there are rules for the spectrum allotment that those people receive their licenses under. And so what happened here, Judge Rogers, is that this was a block of spectrum that was being used by all of these various parties. There are some people who use it for point-to-point communications, a company that transfers data from the home office to the satellite office over a microwave link. And there's also a service called broadband radio service. And the commission had rules for all of those things, but then it decided, well, we think that we have a better use for this spectrum, and so we're going to reallocate this. And part of the reallocation was coming up with rules to move the existing people into new spectrum. And so that would clear out things, and then...
Had any of this started before M2Z filed its original application in May?
Well, when you say this, if you mean the creation of service rules, the answer is no. We had not yet gotten around to that, partly because, as I've mentioned, the full block of spectrum here was not actually fully gotten together until 2005. And in the meantime, the commission has been making service rules, making licensing rules, holding auctions for the other two related blocks of spectrum.
Well, and how do you distinguish AT&T then?
Well, AT&T I think is fundamentally different here. What the commission said in AT&T is we will not rule on the merits of your forbearance petition. We're simply dismissing it out of hand. We're not going to consider this because we have this ongoing rulemaking. In this case, quite differently, we said we are analyzing the merits of your forbearance petition, and your forbearance petition is found wanting. You have not shown that it would be in the public interest for us to forbear from all of these fundamental rules that ensure fairness to other parties and that ensure that the commission has a complete record on which to base its decisions. Having rendered that decision on the merits of the forbearance petition, the commission then said, we will, in order to get this ball rolling, conduct a rulemaking so that we can, in fact, finally get this spectrum licensed. And I think that the postures of the two cases are absolutely and fundamentally different, and they really bear no relation to each other, because here we reached
I understand your point in part, but I guess I don't understand it in full in terms of the bottom line is the commission decided it wished to proceed in this other manner.
Well, the bottom line is not that the commission determined that it wished to proceed in the other manner. I think that the two situations may, in the end, resemble one another in terms of the larger picture of the outcome. But the legal deficiency in AT&T was that the commission had not rendered a fair, reasonable judgment on the forbearance petition. I think here the court can read the commission's order under review, and it can say, yes, the commission reached a reasonable judgment for rejecting this particular forbearance petition, partly on the grounds that it was, as Chief Judge Sentelle pointed out, breathtaking, partly on the grounds that you need to provide pretty good reasons to waive rules that are supposed to ensure fundamental fairness for other parties and that are supposed to ensure that the commission actually has a record on which it can base its decisions. Remember, they came in, they said, here's our proposal. It's so good, you don't even need to look at anything else. And remember, as well, Judge Rogers, that there were six other people who were standing in line also to use this spectrum. And I think in that situation, it's unfair and it's unwise It's a recipe for spectrum mismanagement for the commission to say, we'll take the first proposal that walks in the door. That's not good use of the spectrum. That's not getting the highest and best use out of the public's resources.
So what do you think Congress had in mind here?
I think that Congress had in mind, in Section 7, the idea to get things moving faster as a policy matter, to get the commission to be more receptive to new technology as a policy matter. You know, this was adopted in 1983. You know, at the time there was a Bell system monopoly. There hadn't been cell phones. There, you know, barely was a cable industry at the time. I mean, I think it's rooted in some historical things that were going on in the early 1980s and the late 1970s. But in terms of the language that Congress actually chose to incorporate this policy, it's a policy. It shall be the policy of the United States. And it's clear that Congress wanted the commission to act faster than it had been acting. Some of the legislative history seems to indicate that Congress was concerned that the commission was using economic protection of incumbents from competition as a reason to either not adopt.
In other words, the hypothetical would be someone comes in with something that the commission agrees is new.
That's correct.
All right, and that there is a public interest involved.
That's right, yes.
And that it will enhance the marketplace.
And they say,
but we don't have this great record.
That's right. Or, you know, or we want to protect the monopoly that the X provider has, you know, something like that. I think that's probably what Congress had in mind. Although, to be fair, there's scant legislative history on this, and there's been effectively no genuine commission interpretation of this provision since 1983. The fact is it's typically used as a kind of make-weight argument. You know, the commission adopts something anyway and then says, and this also furthers the goals of Section 7.
So why isn't this new on the hypothetical Judge Rogers gave?
Well, it
sounded new to me. I'm not an expert in this, but it sounded pretty exciting to me.
Well, for one thing, Judge Griffith, before I answer your question directly, can I just say that you're not an expert in it, and that's the very role that the commission plays. We are the expert in it. Congress created the FCC to be the expert. It's not, as M2Z proposed in his brief, simply, you know, what lay people think is new. The fact is, what they propose to provide is wireless broadband access, and there's lots of wireless broadband access. You can go
free nationwide.
Well, not necessarily free nationwide, but you can go into Starbucks and get broadband access.
But the gravamen of their proposal is that it's going to be nationwide and free.
Well, I think that
solve the digital divide. That's new.
Judge Griffith, the new part is the free part. That is not a new service. That's a new economic model, and
substantial enhancement of existing service, right?
It's a economic issue. It's not an actual technical service issue. What they're actually providing is not
new. What difference does that make in terms of the commission deciding what's in the public interest?
Well, I think that, again, the commission here, it's important to remember that Section 7 does not guarantee them a license. They cannot get a license here unless they get forbearance from Rule 1.945, and they cannot get a license here unless they get forbearance from Section 309J1. So that makes this whole Section 7 argument something of a red herring, because Section 7 does not say if somebody says something is new, then you override all of your licensing rules. Then you override all of the statutes that Congress has in place for deciding who gets licenses. Section 7 just says, if you decide it's new, you know, get a move on. Pick up the pace, buddies. And it does not say you get a license automatically. It doesn't even say anything about granting a license. It just says the commission shall decide whether it's in the public interest.
But let me just ask you so I understand. If I came to you with a petition for forbearance that was as broad as this and the commission said this is just breathtaking, it's too broad, but given that you have a new you come within the new, whether it's a service or technology,
mm-hmm.
We're not going to grant the petition as it's filed, but we will grant the necessary forbearance for you to proceed with this new product.
If it were good enough,
then... In other words, I didn't see that as the end of the discussion.
I suppose that Section 7 could be used in combination with other factors, Judge Rogers, as you suggested, to come up with a situation where a license ultimately would be granted. The commission did something like that in a decision called Highcrest. It's referenced in the commission's order. I'd be happy to give you the citation if you want, but somebody came in with something that was new, and the commission said, yeah, this is a great idea, and there are no other applicants for this spectrum, and we think we'll grant you some waivers. They were not waivers of fundamental processing rules. They were waivers of technical rules about the use of the spectrum, and the commission did just that, acting in part on Section 7. But here, I think I cannot stress enough that what they have requested forbearance from are not technical rules about whether you can use your spectrum for omnidirectional or, you know, unidirectional service or something. These are fundamental rules that are supposed to make the process fair and that are supposed to allow the FCC to have enough information to actually act rationally. And quite frankly, it's crazy for the FCC to say, oh, yeah, your proposal looks good. It's new. It's free. Nothing's cheaper than free. And so here you go. For you, other six people.
All right, I get the drift of your argument. What about the objection that the commission on the substantive part, I know your response on the argument that you looked at the wrong market, what about the new combination of technologies as being a new technology?
Well, again, the commission rejected the idea, as I was discussing with Judge Griffith a moment ago, that the service is new, broadband wireless service, it exists. The economic model might be different, but the service is the same. Commission.
What about the difference between orthogonal frequency division multiplexing and orthogonal frequency division, orthogonal frequency division multiplexing.
Okay, well, the commission's understanding.
The thought occurs to me that this illustrates why we can allow cameras in the courtroom if we want to. Nobody's going to watch this.
Chief Judge Santel, there may be a difference in those technologies. For the commission, it basically found, and I think that the article that M2Z itself relies on is cited in their brief and ours, basically says one of those things is a technical variation on the other one. Again, just because you're proposing this, you're proposing to use a new technology, assuming that it's new, to provide slower speeds than other people provide, to provide a slower build out than is typically required, that wouldn't further the public interest. That would retard the public interest. It would subvert the public interest. And I think that it's a little bit as though M2Z had come in and said, we have a great new technology. We're going to use beryllium crystals to provide telegraph service coast to coast. Okay, well, nobody's ever used beryllium crystals for that before, but telegraph service is passe. And they came in and they said, we have a great new proposal to provide slow broadband access that we're going to build out really slowly. And I think that the commission is allowed to say, well, you know, that doesn't serve the public interest, even if your technology is new, which, by the way, it's not.
The commission dealt with that? That's all I'm getting at.
Oh, did it? Oh, yes. Everything that I've said to you.
I thought there was some confusion that this was one and the same thing and that it wasn't new as it's distinct from saying we're taking two known things.
Oh, okay. The commission may not have expressly dealt with the idea that you're taking part A and part B, chocolate and peanut butter, and putting them together into a new candy. But the fact is the commission did deal with the more fundamental question.
You know what you just said? The commission may not have taken into account that you're combining chocolate and peanut butter to create a new candy.
Well,
those are your words.
I understand. The metaphor may have been overstretched, but because here there was no, in fact, new candy. Here, in fact, the commission found that it was the same candy, perhaps in a new wrapper or at a new price point. But the fundamental point is that even if the commission did not explicitly say this combination of technologies is something that nobody has combined before, the commission did find.
Your view is that the commission really has never interpreted Section 7. The pioneer preference came in there and really afforded an opportunity for a lot of new things to happen. Then Congress repealed that. Now we're at a situation where, generally speaking, the fairness, competitive rules are going to apply, and that it will be a rare day when Section 7 moves through in a 12-month period as Congress contemplated?
I don't think that that's quite right. I think it might be a rare day when somebody comes in with a proposal that requires basically the waiver of lots of fundamental rules that are there for very good reasons.
See, but I'm just trying to if I were on behalf, you might ask for the moon, but knowing you'd never get the moon, but, you know, in working with the staff, you'd come up with a method by which your proposal could proceed, forbearing some rules, not all.
And if the rules that were needed to forbear from here were not so fundamental, then the commission might have had a very different approach to this. But I think that you can't really assess this case without realizing what the rules that they're asking for forbearance from do, and without realizing that in their papers before the commission, in their briefs before this court, M2Z has never really said why it's in the public interest to waive those rules, as opposed to why it would be in the public interest to have free broadband service. The rules serve specific interests, and it's critical to address the very specific interests that the rules serve.
They tried to address it by saying, if you look at the record and all the comments from all these different sources, the public safety sector, the education sector, the minority sector, everybody's in favor of this, except the incumbents.
Everybody's in favor.
That's their response.
Well, that's their response. That would be wrong. Everybody's in favor of it who wants free service, except for the other six people who are proposing free service.
Right.
And we don't know. Maybe their proposal's better.
Right.
Maybe instead of, 364, bits per second, they'd have 780 bits per second or a megabit per second, you know. And so that's why it's the comparative consideration that's so important here. That's why, in order for the commission to truly figure out whether something is in the public interest, it has to be the thing that best serves the public interest, not just the first thing that comes in the door and says, I'm a good idea. And that's essentially, nobody's saying that M2Z hasn't proposed a good idea. The commission is still in the process of conducting a rulemaking that very well may end up with M2Z getting a license by auction, by non-auction. It's unclear at this point. But the point isn't that the commission has said, we don't like the idea of free broadband access for everyone, Section 7 be hanged. The commission has moved fairly quickly on this. They ruled within a year of when M2Z first brought up Section 7. They commenced the rulemaking proceeding a week after the order that's before this court was adopted. And, it's been a reasonable time since then, and the commission is actively considering this matter with proposals before the commissioners right now. And so I can't agree with you, Judge Rogers, if you're saying that Section 7 is, irrelevant or overlooked or has no bite here.
I'm not saying anything about Section 7. I'm trying to understand the commission's interpretation of Section 7. It's a big difference.
Well, I think that the commission, there are several aspects of the interpretation. There's the new, there's the service.
Fundamental point of view, it's that the commission has taken the position that it's not going to do what the chief judge had characterized as a breathtaking forbearance, absent some colossal proposal, and even then might not, and that basically it's going to proceed as usual unless it can make this determination that you're talking about.
I think when you say as usual, that's where you and I part ways, Judge Rogers, because the commission has...
Well, as usual is a notice of proposed rulemaking.
Oh, okay.
Having a record, having anybody who wants to file an application come in and file it.
Well, we've done this fairly quickly, especially by commission time, and we have taken it very seriously.
Right, okay.
But I don't think that Section 7 is a magic wand that you wave over the commission and you get a license.
We're in agreement. We just have to decide what is it.
Okay. Well, if we're trying to figure out exactly what Section 7 does or doesn't do, you know, that may very well be one of the numerous things that M2Z didn't really raise before the commission. They attempted to invoke Section 7 as this kind of magic wand, but you know, in terms of putting meat on the bones, I think that they.
Well, I was going to ask about that. You know, again, to a non-expert reading, when you read the application under Section 10 and the petition under Section 7, it never actually says this is a new service or a new technology. Now, maybe everybody in the field understands if you file under those sections, automatic.
No, I think that your instincts are exactly right, Judge Rogers. I think if you turn to page 597, oh, I'm sorry, it's 658 of the joint appendix. You will see.
Give me that page number again.
Yes, Chief Judge Sentell, 658. And this is in a pleading filed by M2Z. I'll give you a moment to get there.
Okay, thank you.
They say M2Z's proposal is pioneering in economic terms, but the application seeks no preferential treatment on the basis of the technology that M2Z proposes to deploy. And then on the next page, 659, it says M2Z does not seek to justify its request for a license merely by reference to the nature of the technological innovations that M2Z proposes. And then, you know, it goes on to say at the bottom of page 659, unlike the pioneer's preference applications, we seek a license because of the broad range of public interest and consumer welfare benefits rather than on the basis of technological innovations alone. In other words, they came to us and they said, basically, this is not a technological issue. I mean, if you're talking about 405 waivers, then I think that, you know, there's a big whopping one right there. They came to us and they specifically said, this is not about our new technology. This is about our pioneering economic proposal. And again, this just goes back to what Judge Griffith and I were talking about, which is that they came up with a nifty economic idea, but that is not necessarily a new service as Congress and the FCC have interpreted that term. And I don't think that that M2Z here is given really any good basis to question the Commission's interpretation and application of those terms, even if they had been raised before the Commission.
Thank you.
So we would ask that the Court affirm the Commission's order. Thank you.
If there are no further questions, then how much time did the petitioner have left?
48 seconds.
We'll round that up to 2 minutes, Mr. Dinn.
Mr. Dean, could you begin by responding to counsel's citation to pages 658 and 659 of the?
Yes, Your Honor. There has been no waiver because the last two sentences read to contain the word merely and alone. That application said that it's not on technology alone or merely because of technological advances. It was not a waiver of the Section 7 argument. It was not explicitly flagged as Section 7, but there is no magic words or clear statement requirement under Section 7. And indeed, just for belts and suspenders, by September 1st, when we file our petition for forbearance, we expressly waiving any arguments to the contrary, say that we're invoking Section 7.
Or one sentence in there doesn't have any alones or any onlys in it. M2Z's proposal is pioneering, italicized, in economic terms, but the application seeks no preferential treatment on the basis of the technology that M2Z proposes to deploy.
I think that it is a pioneering proposal. That's fair enough in order
in
to include a Section 7.
It seeks no preferential treatment on the basis of technology.
And we do not think that preferential treatment under Section 7 is a preferential treatment. It is a simple statutory burden shifting requirement. It does not get you a first in line for free spectrum analysis. All that it does and all that we ask for is an honest, well-considered consideration and decision on the merits of the public interest of our application. Section 309A, the authority on which we rely for application, is far from being an ad hoc provision. It is the general authority under which the FCC grants 300,000 licenses a year. That is the default for which the agency acts, and the agency accepted our application for filing in this particular case. This spectrum was flagged for new technology and services in 1992 by the FCC at the time. In 2002, it was flagged for specifically advanced wireless services, and in 2005, as counsel has correctly noted, it was aggregated, and subsequent to that, the reallocation rule for pre-existing minor uses was adopted. And it was only then that M2Z came in and said, wait a minute, you've tried to do this for 14 years. We are now going to propose a way under Section 10 and under Section 7 for you to allocate the spectrum. All that we ask for is a fair consideration of the public interest of our application. Instead, what the FCC did was to give the public interest of its auctioning rules, which do not contest, paramount weight, and says that we will decide not to decide. And that's squarely foreclosed by AT&T. Your Honor, one correction for the record. The Section 7 was passed in 1983, but it was amended and therefore reaffirmed by Congress in 1994. And Section 10, the forbearance provision, was not passed until the Deregulatory Telecommunications Act of 1996. And so in all of these situations, Congress clearly meant to have a proposed way through which applicants like M2Z, who takes the initiative and moves as a first mover to seek the spectrum, to have just simply a reasoned, considered decision-making on the merits, on the public interest, convenience, and necessity of its application. Here, we have had no such opportunity for consideration or decision on that merit, rather simply a punt to a 309J procedure, which procedure, by the way, under paragraph 6E, Your Honor.
We actually are well past the time we've allotted for rebuttals. Unless my colleagues have further questions, I think we'll submit this case.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Give us a recess.